Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Borders Blatherings, the podcast where published historian Mary Craig and I get together, have a chat, and try and shine a light on the curious, shadowy, and often very magical history of the Scottish borderlands. Mary, hi.
Hello, hello.
I suspect that this is the second part of a two-part series on the Great War.
Indeed, yes.
If I can remind you of the last time we met, we talked about the lead-up to the Great War, 1418 War, the impact that it had on this region we live in.
Yes.
And then we talked about events during the war. And although I think we blethered for more than half an hour, I hadn't got in the idea of, why don't we talk about the aftermath?
Yes, what happened afterwards.
The war,
yeah.
And the impact, because there were many changes here in the borders as a result of the war, the upsetting of the fabric of the mills, the agricultural landscape which we have here. But before we get into that aftermath, can I take you back to a question that has long haunted me?
Mm-hmm.
Why, in your opinion, because you're the historian, did Britain enter this war? Because my minimal understanding of the situation is that for a long time, Britain was teetering on the verge of neutrality.
Yes.
In a sense. I can see why the French did. I can see other things. But what for you is the main reason that Britain actually entered the war?
That, to me, is a really interesting question.
Thank you.
We know that there were all these treaties and alliances. We know that the French and the Russians were pals.
Yes.
And we had the Entente Cordiale with the French.
Entente Cordiale.
We know that the Germans and the Austrians and the Ottomans and all these different countries had all these little different treaties. Mm. And I always think of it, if you think of them all sort of connected with bits of string, and if you pull one bit of string, all the other bits of strings fall.
Yeah.
But we were slightly different in that we had our empire. We were focused on Ireland and the Irish question.
There was an issue, yeah.
And we are a physical island off the side of Europe. So it means that, you know, nobody's going to just come across our border the way France could go into Germany or vice versa. So for ages, we weren't sure who we were going to side with. And for every peace rally, there were the hotheads shouting, you know, for every hawk, there was a dove sort of type thing.
So there's a more or less an equal amount of pro-anti.
Yes, absolutely. And the Liberal government really wasn't sure. They really weren't sure what they wanted to do.
Is this Lord Grey?
They're really not sure what they're going to do. And, of course, the French are pushing and pushing and pushing. And the French came to us, and the ambassador is sitting on the 3rd of August, and they're pushing and pushing and pushing. And they're using all these arguments. Oh, well, Germany's going to take over, and it's going to be this big, strong nation, and we can't let them away with it. And
look at their
navy,
look at their
birthday, look at the technology, look at the Krupp's factories, and look at all of this. And all of these rational arguments weren't working until the French said one last thing, looked straight into Grey's face and said, have the British no honour?
Well, that would do it.
And that would do it. Because I maintain in history, we sometimes forget that history is a story of human beings. And human beings will put up with a lot. We will not put up with humiliation or ridicule. Nobody wants a custard pie in the face. Nobody wants to be the country without honour. And that was just enough to tip Grey for him to take that back to the cabinet, to push the cabinet, and by the next again day, we declared war on Germany.
So that was a heavily loaded gauntlet that the French threw down.
Absolutely.
And it did the trick.
It did the trick, and they knew it was their last card they could play, and they played it, and they played it magnificently.
Uh-huh.
And that was why we went in. And if there had been a different ambassador with a different attitude and he hadn't used that phrase, mm-hmm. I think there's a reasonable chance we would have stayed neutral. Because lots of countries did.
Yeah.
I think we could have done, and we might have done as America did, come into the war later. Or we might have, for example, supplied the French and the Belgians and the Russians with supplies, you know. But I don't think we would have been a belligerent.
Fascinating, because linguistically, this is the French are saying, what you Brits are doing is just not cricket.
Yes, something
it's
like that.
It's beating
yes.
them at their own game.
Absolutely,
a
yeah. Like words are powerful.
Words
and
are
words
very powerful, yeah.
That contain an emotion. Words that tap into to a human emotion are incredibly powerful. Nobody wants to lose their dignity. Mm. Nobody does not want to be respected. Humiliation, ridicule. And the French, they were, you know, we were old countries. France would absolutely, we would have known, every French person from then on in would have looked at us and said, the British are without honour.
Mm.
And we were still in an era where honour mattered. I hope it still matters today, but absolutely it mattered then.
I am actually, as you say this, I'm wondering if it does matter as much because present day, reality TV, it seems to me that many people are queuing up to be ridiculed.
To be ridiculed and humiliated.
And humiliated in public.
On the off chance that they're going to win the prize. Yeah, all of those programmes are based on that. We all watch those programmes because we want to see the person cry, or we want to see the person fall down, or we want to see the person forced to eat some disgusting bit of food.
Yeah.
That's the money shot, as they would say in television, is you can see the cameras honing in when somebody's about to burst into tears. Mm-hmm. We're going back to when we used to put people in the stocks and throw tomatoes at them.
It's a bit like putting them in the stocks, yeah.
Just laughing at them.
I read, maybe it's true or not, but I read that the former health secretary, when Matt Hancock went into the jungle thing.
Yes.
People were actually
phoning up every
phoning
week.
Up
yes.
to make sure he did the most horrible task
yep.
possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm.
Indeed.
Interesting.
However, the French did not have to do that. They just had to have their one phrase. I wish I could speak French. I'm not going to even attempt to mangle that phrase, but it worked. Have the British no honour. Uh-huh. And the following morning, we declared war on Germany.
Let them eat cold porridge. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. Because it's a question I ask myself often. What actually drove Britain in to that conflict?
Yes,
For a long time, it looked like neutrality was the way forward. But that was my intro. Let's then look at the aftermath. During episode one, you talked eloquently about the impact of the events leading up to and during the Great War had on agriculture, had on the mills here, and so on and so forth. Let's shift a little bit to peace and the aftermath here. And the first thing that springs to mind, and I mentioned it, I think, in the first time we met, when I lived in America, I noticed that a lot of the war veterans were treated with a great deal of respect, had access to a lot of facilities and discounted goods and so on and so forth. Mm. What happened here in the borders for those coming back from conflict?
Well, the problem was that the fighting on the Western Front stops November the 11th, carried on for a little bit in other areas, but the war is more or less over. Some people came home for Christmas, not all, but most folk came home from Christmas. The problem was that although it was, oh great, the war's over, daddy's coming home, my husband's coming home, my brother's coming home, the soldiers that came back were unbelievably damaged.
Yeah.
Some had lost limbs. Some had lost their sight. A lot had lost their hearing because artillery is extremely loud.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost all of them had what would now be recognised as PTSD.
Yeah.
Because the Great War was the first sort of mechanised war. But in the early stages, we were still fighting it as if we were going to still be charging about the backs of horses with bayonets and things like that.
The French in particular with their white gloves.
They were still doing cavalry charges, poor things. So you could be in a trench and literally a shell could explode and blow your friend's head to smithereens and bits of your friend could land on you. And there was nothing you could do about it. You just had to stand there and fight. It had been hell. I mean, literally hell for these men.
Yeah, yeah.
And they came back and that was it. So at first it's, oh, great, Daddy's home. But then, oh, right, Daddy's missing an arm. How does Daddy work as a farm worker with a missing arm? Well, you can't really, can you? Or a missing leg.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're blind. And you get PTSD, which you don't recognise. I mean, shell shock was recognised for officers, but not for men.
Mm.
Interesting.
Yes,
oh,
interesting.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, common people. They're not as nervous, you see. They're not as emotional, common people. So,
obviously,
they're not going to be
affected.
Yes. We're not affected.
We're not affected. Okay.
So, Daddy comes home for Christmas 1918, and it's all very lovely at first. And then you get into sort of January, and then you realise that Daddy can't work. Because he's lying in his bed and every time a gun goes off locally, because it's a hunt and shoot and fishing in the borders, he's cowering under the blankets because he's terrified. So Daddy can't work. He's not contributing to the household, but he's another mouth to feed because he's not got any money from the army anymore. So what does he do? There's the fact that he is scared and angry and upset. And instead of being able to yell at the beastly hun or somebody, who does he yell at? His wife? His children? So there's all sorts of family changes there. So you think Daddy's coming home and it's going to be lovely and wonderful, but Daddy's now quite a scary person and he shouts after you if you make any noise. And then, of course, before the war, Daddy used to be head of the household and he used to be the man that was bringing in the wages, and now he's not. He's in a chair in the corner and Mummy goes out to work. Well, how does Daddy feel about that? Because his masculinity, he spent the past 4.5 years being really macho and fighting.
Yeah.
And now his wife wears the pants, as it were. So there's that dynamic. You know, you go from being big and brave and strong and with all your mates and you're in very male companies and you're doing the physicality of being a soldier to sitting and watching your wife get up in the morning, feed the kids, do the housework and go out to a job in the mill or go out to work in the farm.
Yeah.
And you just sort of sit there. You've got nothing to do. Well, that's for old men. So psychologically, it's a massive thing for you to do.
That's great social change, yeah.
Huge social change. And, of course, remember, this is the period when the suffragettes are kicking off. I mean, the suffragettes were around before the Great War.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sort of suspended activities, if you like, during the war. But the minute the war was over, they're like, right back. So the role of women is changing. Here's you. You've gone out to fight in a war. For 4 odd years, you've been out there fighting, doing something. And you come back to a world that you don't recognise. That you psychologically, people are looking at you. And you don't talk about the war. Now, we'd won the war, remember? So that's great, isn't it? And you've got, maybe even got a medal.
Defied one.
Exactly. You've won the war and you've got a medal. You've got no income. You've got no money. You've not got your mental health. You might not have your physical health. So what are you supposed to do? There were men that survived gas attacks, and gas attacks were horrific. The problem with gas attacks was that some men survived them. Great, fine. You come home.
Yeah.
You've got damaged lungs. And you've then got to work as a farm labourer. Maybe you can do a bit of work. And you're working outdoors. In cold, wet border winters.
Yeah.
If you die in 1917 or 1918 of a gas attack, your wife might get a payment. If your lungs are so damaged that you only last for 4 or 5 or 6 years after the war and you die in 1924 because of a bad border winters affected your lungs, your wife's not getting anything.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's the effects of the gassing that killed you, but nobody cares at this point. The Borders did set up disabled servicemen clubs. They were set up around the country, across the country. They were very much set up locally in the Borders. Sometimes the Duke of Buccleuch, the Duke of Roxburgh would give a bit of money. And the local, the bigger landowners and the bigger farmers would give a bit of money to set up these groups. And the men would have dinners. But what they ended up was it would be a dinner once a year or twice a year. You got a posh dinner.
Yeah.
And that was all you got.
It
wasn't actually doing anything. You know what I mean? It wasn't helping you get a job. It wasn't helping you get a decent wooden leg, because the limbs for the disabled were incredibly crude and basic unless you could afford decent ones, which most working people couldn't do. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were really, really lucky and your family had worked for the Duke of Buccleuch for generations, you might get a helping hand there, but often not. Some of the big landowners allowed wives to stay in tied cottages whilst their husbands were away at the war.
Yeah.
The husband comes back, but he's not fit to work the land. Well, I'm sorry, out the cottage.
Out you go.
Out you go.
Yep.
So people get moved off the land and you maybe move into a border town like Selkirk or Hoyk or Gala. Can you get a job as a weaver? Can you work as a weaver if you've only got one arm and you've never trained as a weaver before? Is the mill even going to take you on? Because they're going to say, well, you've only got one arm. Can I work the loom with one arm or one leg?
Yeah.
What if you're blind? As a lot of men were. Or what if you're constantly coughing and it might just be that your lungs are damaged from the gas? People are looking at you, what's he got? Has he got something weird? Mm. And then, of course, remember, the Spanish flu pitched up as well, just to add to the chaos.
So
everything is in flux, everything is upended. You've come home a hero to what? To the same tied cottage, if you're lucky, and if not, to some cramped little tenement flat in Overhorse Street in Gala Shields.
So you've painted a picture that is actually quite sad, because what you have prior to the Great War is a strong, skilled or semi-skilled farm worker.
Yes.
Head of the household.
Yes.
Responsible person, goes through four and a half years of this, and then comes back a broken person.
Yes. And there is nothing there.
But there is, Mary. As I walk around, I see war memorials. War memorials were built in your honour.
Yes.
Mister.
Yes.
Your name is on that war memorial.
Oh, is it? Is your name on that war memorial? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
Everyone's name would be on that, surely.
Absolutely not, no. So whilst the local landowner is deciding that he's going to give you a meal twice a year, his good lady wife has decided that she wants to have a war memorial built. So she's down the local stonemasons picking out some nice pink granite or something to put up a little war memorial. And then she'll form a committee with two or three of her friends. The minister from the church will be in there, of course, and, you know, maybe the doctor sort of type thing. And they will draw up a list of names.
Well, like planning a wedding.
Indeed.
The seating arrangements.
Absolutely. So they've decided who's going on the war memorial. And they would spend hours deciding about what, you know, was it going to be pink marble and what was the design going to be and where was it going to be situated and oh, la-di-da-di-da. And then what they would do is they would send a notice out, usually through the church, to say, if you have lost a loved one, put their names in to the committee. But that did not mean that the name was definitely going on the war memorial.
Oh, my word.
Now, in some cases, you end up with double names. So let's say if you had a youngster who was born in Stow and died. His mum and dad would put him on the Stow war memorial. But let's say as an adult, he had moved to Gala Shields and got married. His wife might get him on the Gala Shields memorial.
Mm.
That happened. But unfortunately, let's say you were a bit of a bad lad in Selkirk and your family had a bit of a reputation. But your family put the name forward to the committee and the committee went, well, we're not having him on there. Oh, no, we're not having him on there because, I mean, you know what that family's like? Bet he didn't do much fighting anyway. Oh, no, because my Jimmy's name's going on and my Davy's name's going on. No, we're not having Archie. So Archie's name never got put on the war memorial.
My eyes are opening wide here. I cannot believe
Didn't happen a lot, but it did happen. It absolutely did happen. And again, you've got to stand there because there's a great unveiling ceremony, of course, and the newspapers are there and, oh, Lady this and Lord Muck and all the rest are all there being ever so, and they've paid for the whole thing and la-di-da-di, and you're sitting there thinking, maybe Archie's name's not on there. Why is it not on? Why is it not on? And of course, anybody who'd been a deserter and been shot as a deserter, their names weren't on. So if you were a deserter, your name wasn't on. Conscientious objectors, sometimes their names were not put on because, well, they'd only been stretcher bearers.
Even
they hadn't
if they
actually
went
done
in
any
to
fighting.
Be stretcher bearers.
No,
or
they hadn't really done any fighting, had they? So they don't want their names on. And as I say, if Archie's family is not very well liked, his name's not going on either.
So Lady Muck, Lady X, whose husband has paid for this war memorial,
yes.
is deciding which names do or do not get engraved.
When I say they paid for the war memorial, they only sort of paid for part of it. A lot of the rest was paid for by public subscription. So the local community might have paid for half of it as well, but still, no, Archie's name's not going on
the
there because his
society.
Family.
Okay. Wow.
And so, you know, so you're going to get a dinner twice a year. And you're going to bow and scrape. And again, if you come from a bad family, you might not get invited to the dinner. So you might not even get the free dinner. So you're getting a free dinner twice a year. Hooray. And your dead brother's name might be on a war memorial. But there's no job for you because you've lost an arm, you've lost a leg. You can't work in the rural countryside. You can't work in the mill. Your wife's now out earning a wage. The only thing you can do is go to the pub and get drunk.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hello, my name is Alison Larkin, and I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of the Jane Austen podcast. This podcast brings Jane Austen's stories to the 21st century, along with commentary from me and conversations with fascinating people who all share a love of Jane Austen. And of course, we had to start with none other than Pride and Prejudice. So join me as we embark on a journey through some of the most wonderful stories I know. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So does this situation, so clearly there's a need for farm workers, agricultural workers.
Yes.
Does this lead to a significant migration? Do we see a lot of population movement into the borders consequently?
No. What you tend to see is even more flipping sheep turning up.
We've been there before.
I know. Because if you haven't got people to plough your fields, you can get rural workers from somewhere. But of course, remember, there's a dearth of rural workers because, of course, there's a dearth of men.
Exactly.
There are no men, right? And women can do rural work, but it's difficult and it's hard work. And at that time, it was frowned upon. So what you think is, well, I can't plough the fields for crops. I'll stick a couple more sheep on it. And some of the bigger estates, what you do is you turn it over to definitely hunt, shooting, fishing. So you turn it into more of a shooting estate.
Yeah.
Because then you don't need as many staff. Some of the bigger estates sell off some of their land. You let the land lie fallow, or you put in some timber. And there was a need for timber after the Great War because so much had been chopped.
Mm.
But once you planted all your trees, well, that's a 30-year
crop.
So you
get a lot of tree planting,
But that's a 30-year crop. So you don't really need huge amounts of workers.
Mm.
So, I mean, for basic farm labouring jobs, you can get people doing bits and pieces. But you have got a definite change there. And in the mills, you've got a definite change. You've got a lot more women weaving, because women traditionally were spinners and they now go into weaving. So you get more women going into mills, which of course the mill owners like, because you can pay women less than men, even though they're doing the same job, but that's quite good fun. So, you know, you've got a little bit of that going on there. So there's a lot of changes going on there. There were lots of changes with, well, did your daddy fight and die? How come my daddy died and your daddy didn't die? So for children, and of course you couldn't, you had to be proud of daddy. Daddy had fought in the war against the beastly Hun. And of course we'd had all the stuff during the war of, you know, little dachshunds being kicked off pavements and sauerkraut becoming victory cabbage and all these sorts of things. So, but that lingered for a long time. And of course, because we had decided that it was, the war had been Germany's fault, although it wasn't, and I will argue with any other historian who wants it was in Germany's fault.
I wanted to end with that
question. We'll get
question.
To that in a minute. You know, but we still had this, the beastly Hun were out there and your daddy fought the beastly Hun. And if you hadn't fought, if nobody from your family had fought, it's like, my daddy fought and died. Well, why did your daddy not go? Or how come I've lost three of my sons and none of yours went? So there's a lot of resentment there amongst people because they didn't understand what had happened. And then, of course, there's also the fact that there were some lads that didn't come back because they'd found a nice little French mademoiselle and fallen in love.
Yes.
So you get that in a war as well.
Like the Scottish football team in Argentina.
Indeed. And the thing is that you can carry if you're in the Central Belt. If you're in Glasgow or Edinburgh and 20% of your active male population is either not there or disabled, you can carry that. You can't carry that in a rural population in the borders because there just isn't the numbers. And economies of scale work in rural areas just as much as they do in the Central Belt. So you are struggling. And the mills did start to dip a little bit. Because they just couldn't produce what they were producing previously. They couldn't manage it. And so a lot of them were very reliant on female workers and very reliant on the lower wages. And that's how the mills survived. The mills survived by paying women a third less than they were paying the men. And that's how they got away with it.
So there's a really significant change in work patterns then.
Very much so, yes.
In the aftermath.
Yes. Yeah, and of course, because you've got the rise of the suffragettes as well, that's an added thing for men, you know, because women were saying things like, well, we did go into the munitions factories, we did run the trams, we did do all of these things, we should be entitled to vote. And because the numbers, as we go into 1919 and 1920, the numbers that had died, the absolute bloody carnage of the Great War is becoming more and more apparent. And people are angry, and it is that old, you know, lions led by donkeys. And a lot of young officers did die. I mean, the death rate amongst junior officers, was horrific. But people were angry, and there was nowhere for the anger to go. Especially if you're in Glasgow and you're angry, you join the Socialist Party, you start going in rallies, you go to George Square and you yell at the town, at the city chambers. If you're angry in the Scottish borders, what do you do? You can't shout at the Duke of Buccleuch because you're in his tied cottage. You can't shout at the Duke of Roxburgh, otherwise you're going to end up with no work at all. So the only way you can do is internalise all that anger and take it out on your family. That's all you can do. Or drink yourself into oblivion because there's no outlet for your anger. There's no outlet for the fact that you've lost three of your sons or four of your brothers or whatever it is.
And that emotional, that outpouring of, the thing you mentioned earlier of, you know, my daddy died in that war, yours didn't. When I lived in the States, I remember an artist had, there was an installation by an artist in a gallery, and in order to view it, the viewer had to step upon the American flag. And this caused an absolute outrage because, again, my grandfather died. My father died for this flag.
For this flag.
And often, well, I bought one in Kmart. You know, this kind of, and the emotions are very high over things like that. Very much.
Yeah. And then, of course, as you go forward and the peace conference starts up in Paris and all the politicians get together and decide that they're going to sort out the aftermath of this and there's going to be a lasting peace and all the rest of it. And so they decide that, right, you need a scapegoat. Because every single country that had been a belligerent was now sitting there going, oopsie, look how many men we slaughtered for practically nothing. What the hell were we thinking? This was an absolute outrage. I mean, before the war started, all of the banks in all of the European countries were saying, don't do this. Mm-hmm. This is going to absolutely cripple us. Do not do this.
Yeah.
Almost all of the industries, with the exception of the armaments industry, obviously were saying, don't do this. It's going to kill our infrastructure. It's going to kill our transport. It's going to kill our agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to the peace conference and they're all got egg on their face. So what do? Do you admit that you foolishly went into a war because the French were going to laugh at you?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to admit that you went to war because, well, Russia said they would do this? We need a scapegoat. Who can we pick on?
Said earlier in this podcast, we won the war. So we need, by definition, a loser.
A loser.
So who was that?
It's going to be Germany.
It is indeed.
It's going to be Germany.
Yeah.
Because there's no point in picking at Austria, because Austria's fallen to bits.
Yeah.
There's no point. And anyway, Austria isn't our rival. Now, in the very early 19th century, Austria was our rival, but Germany was our economic rival. Germany was our naval rival. That's who we want to pick up. Russia has dissolved into revolution, so it's not them. It can't be France, because we were on the same side as them. We're not picking on Serbia, because we're not quite sure if we can find it on a map, and we're not sure about what's going on in the Balkans, as per usual, because we don't really care. Who does that leave us with? We could have a go at the Ottomans. Oh, no, better not, because they're getting pretty close to our empire. We don't want to annoy them. Okay, Germany, because we don't like them, and we can blame them, and they are our rivals.
But in a sense, is Germany not like a modern-day offshore tax haven for many wealthy British industrialists? Because they're involved in the manufacturing
base
in Germany.
But you have to pick on somebody, because otherwise you're going to have to admit that it was your own silly fault, that a war started over nothing, that you could have sat around a table and prevented, but you didn't. Millions of people died. Millions of people were maimed. Infrastructure, agriculture, everything was damaged. So you either blame that, and you would have to explain that Britain, instead of staying neutral, went to war simply because the French challenged us. Oh, no, you can't admit to
all this. So we need a scapegoat.
We need a scapegoat. Let's pick on Germany.
Yeah. And what do we do? Do we wrap them over the knuckles, or do we severely punish them for that? Because they started it.
This is the problem, is that by the time the peace conference is up and running, America's bored. Because it's European, they don't really care. I mean, the Paris Peace Conference was fascinating. Half the delegates didn't turn up in time. All the little countries turned up. All the little countries that used to be part of Austria, Hungary, turned up and said, well, can we get in? And other countries are going, who are you? Bosnia, Herzegovina, how do you pronounce that? Who are you? What are you?
Mm-hmm.
You're a Ruthenian. What's a Ruthenian? Nobody knew what was going on.
And the Americans are holding all the IOUs as well.
Exactly.
So even
the delegates that turned up, half the delegates couldn't arrive in Paris because guess what? The transport infrastructure was gone. And they had no money to travel. They pitch up in Paris. There were tents along the Seine for half of them. So that's fine. The French have decided that they're absolutely going to hammer the Germans because it's their turn to be in the driving seat because Germany and France spend their whole time fighting, right? So France is ecstatic that they've won. And to be fair to France, a huge swathe of their country had been damaged and hundreds of men had died at Verdun. And again, they weren't going to blame themselves for what happened in that battle. So they were going to absolutely punish the Germans. Russia didn't care anymore because it was busy having a revolution. The Americans got bored halfway through the conference and basically left because it was a European issue. And we sort of thought, well, actually, oh, flip Ireland. Yeah, Ireland's kicking off again. We need to concentrate on Ireland. Oh, yeah, whatever. Oh, yeah, Germany, that'll do.
Yeah.
That'll do. And so the reparations that were put in place were ridiculous, but it wasn't just the financial reparations. It was the French saying, right, we want the whole of the Ruhr Valley. We want the whole of your coal fields and you know, we just absolutely, it was what today happens on social media. It is what you would call a pile-on. There was a pile-on on a poor old Germany. Now, don't get me wrong, Germany was not blameless. But neither was any other country in Europe. with a very few exceptions, we all, you know, Austria picking on the Slavs and Russia getting in the game, and then France pushing, and then Germany, and then us, you know, it wasn't as if Germany was blameless, but it absolutely wasn't the prime suspect, as they would say. But there was absolutely a pile on afterwards, because now, who else was there?
Yeah, you often hear from people who are perhaps not, as I call you, a proper historian, the Second World War started the day the Great War ended. Do you buy into that?
More or less, yes. Because if you think about it, the Great War, we stopped fighting in 1918 in the Western Front.
Yeah.
They were fighting in Germany from 1918 onwards.
Onwards, yeah.
They were fighting in Austria. They were fighting in Spain. There was fighting. Just because we weren't fighting, and just because the French weren't fighting, and just because the Americans weren't fighting, there was fighting going on at various different levels right the way across Europe, including what was, you know, the Spanish Civil War. So if you think of the Hundred Years' War between England and France, they didn't fight every single day. They fought, and then they rested in the off-season, and sometimes they fought for a couple of years, and then sometimes they didn't fight for 3 or 4 years, and yet we class that as a Hundred Years' War. So yes, I would say the Great War started 1914 and finished around about 45.
Yeah.
Different people fought at different times. But yes, it was more or less a continuous conflict.
Because you referenced, say, the Spanish Civil War. Now, the German Luftwaffe were using the Spanish Civil War to test out the damage the planes could do.
And so they
are, in a sense, what's the old saying? If you want to maintain peace, prepare for a war.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you look at the fighting between the socialists and the communists and the fascists in Germany, it basically kicked off. Because the minute the war ended, the Germans were in a very strong position in the Western Front.
Yes.
But we'd all basically fought ourselves to exhaustion. And the German army was flipping angry at their politicians. And they turned that anger inwards. And they just started fighting on the streets of Germany.
Yeah.
And you have people like Walter Rathenau being assassinated and all sorts of in the start of the Nazi party and all of this lot. And they're kicking off wars.
And that was it. You say you won, but we didn't lose.
We didn't lose.
And that whole mentality seeped through Germany.
It was the same in Austria. Yeah. They were fighting on the streets of Vienna. It was the same throughout Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and in Hungary, Romania, all of these countries were still fighting.
Yeah. Yeah.
The war ended more or less for us and for France and for America, but for most other countries it continued. So yes, I am one of the ones that thinks that, like the Hundred Years' War, we weren't all continuously fighting all the time. But to me it was more or less one war, that lasted for almost all of that first 50 years of the 20th century. Yeah.
So why then, I'm told there's no such thing as a stupid question, but why then has Germany, in a sense, retrospectively been blamed for the start of the Great War?
Because, as I say, it's easier.
Why have we got there?
It's easier to... I can understand at the time it was easier to choose a scapegoat than admit the faults of the nations. Because, you know, all of the other countries had a hand in the start of the Great War.
Indeed.
And I would argue that France and Russia were slightly more to blame than Germany.
Yeah.
So I can understand at the time that was what was blamed.
Mm-hmm.
After the Great War, nobody wanted to talk about it. Because so many people had died, so many people had lost loved ones. And the legacy, if you turn round to Jimmy from Selkirk, who's lost a leg and lost an arm and is more or less destitute, and say, you do realise that actually it was sort of Britain's own fault that we got involved in this war. So you turn around and say, wait a minute, I lost an arm and a leg for stupidity.
Yeah, yeah.
You lost an arm and a leg because of the beastly Hun. Oh, all right, okay.
That's easier to swallow.
And that's easier to swallow.
Yeah.
And yep. because the men who did come back didn't talk about the war, because one didn't at that time, but how can you explain the horrors you'd gone through anyway to somebody who hadn't been there? That continues on. And so when the crash happens in 29, we're all worried about our money. We're not worried about the war at this point. We're just all worried about money. And then we just sort of stagger our way to getting past that. And Hitler pops up and you go, oh, see, see, we told you, it's the beastly Hun. And so that's why that perpetuates. And then by the time you get into the back of the Second World War, you have the horrors of the Holocaust. So there you are, big bad Germany, beastly Hun. And so there's never been a chance for Germany to sort of turn around and sort of pull its reputation back. It was just unfortunate series of the way it went. And because most people actually don't read history either. So, and the start of the First World War is just a mess.
It is. Yeah.
And it is complex and complicated. And you just look at it and you think, oh, come on. Really? Really? But no, it's just Germany was never given that chance. And then, of course, by the time we get to the end of the Second World War, we're then into the Cold War where it becomes really more complex.
Yeah.
You've got East Germany and West Germany and the Soviet bloc, and it becomes very complicated and very scary, very difficult to understand.
Yeah.
History is always messy because it's what human beings get up to, and we
are
silly, emotional, subjective little so-and-sos. It's much easier to say, the beastly Hun started. Oh, you know where you are with that. I don't need to worry about that. I don't need to try and understand it any more than that.
Thinking of times now, are we ever going to run out of scapegoats?
Yeah.
Really?
I know
okay.
what you mean.
Is the Daily Mail ever going to run out of scapegoats?
Oh, scapegoats, yeah. It just makes life easier.
Yeah.
And it makes life easier for governments. Because if you can blame the beastly Hun or the asylum seekers or the Jews or whoever you're blaming, you know, that lets government off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an ordinary person who's worried about paying your rent or paying your electricity bill, if there's an easy scapegoat, then, you know, that's easier for you as well. Whereas if you have to think about the war that's going on in Ukraine and how that's affecting energy supplies, which is why you can't put the kettle on... That becomes, because there's nothing you can do about that. Whereas if there's a nice, easy scapegoat, which the government controlling media will tell you the scapegoat is X or Y or Z, it doesn't make the situation any physically better, but emotionally it gives you something or someone to blame. It's not your fault you can't feed your kids. It's Putin and the war in Russia, the war in Ukraine, or it's not my fault that my daughter hasn't got housing. It's the big bad asylum seekers.
There's no end to that in a sense, because it is, as I heard recently, a committed Brexiteer claiming that the reason our trade agreements haven't peaked, as we told you, it's Joe Biden's fault. And that makes me think, are we ever going to run out of scapegoats?
Yeah. It just makes life easier if you have someone to blame. Because that way...
And enough people swallow
not,
that.
It's not my fault. And if you have control of the media, and if you look at all of the conflicts that are happening around the world at the moment, governments are doing what they're doing for their reasons. Ordinary people might have an opinion, but you can only work on the information you're given. And if your government is making sure, whether they control your media completely or they have enough control that they can push their mission, they can push their propaganda just as they did in the Great War. The beastly Hun were disemboweling babies and raping nuns, apparently.
And eating them,
Yes, that's right, you know. And there's a wonderful, for anybody that really wants to follow this, this history thread much more, there is a wonderful 1964 BBC documentary series about the Great War. I think you can get it on YouTube. And what is interesting about it is that there are interviews in there from German men that fought on their side. And they were astonished. They were horrified by the propaganda that was said against them that they were bayoneting babies. And we still use the phrase the beastly Hun. I mean, it's over 100 years since the war ended, and I know that phrase.
Yeah.
And it's a very poignant documentary as to what happened, and to hear these men that fought in the war, from the German side as well as the British side. So if anybody wants to cheese up the Great War, I would advise you, because these were the men that were actually there, as opposed to me, who's read it in a book.
Well, that's the thing. When I worked in a hospital, washing pans and dishes in America, I was friendly with two sisters from Germany, both of whom were at various rallies, and they were certainly in Nuremberg, and witnessed Adolf Hitler walk past them.
Wow.
And listen to him speak. Mm-hmm. And to hear them tell about the impressions they had, and the euphoria, and the feelings that they had, is so different from picking up a textbook.
Of course, yes. That's always,
the story is king.
That's it. That's always the way with history. You have to remember that it is stories in the word history for a reason. And it's about human beings and our emotions. We're not rational. The Enlightenment can do whatever it wants. We're not rational. We are not objective. We are emotional and subjective. All that we have are our emotions and our experiences. And if you always remember that when you're reading a historical account of an event, then you start to understand what it was like. And for the people in the borders, the women in the borders who had 4 years of worry and stress about their loved ones, but also having to pick up the pieces in a way they'd never had to do and provide for families in a way they'd never had to do. And for the men who fought and came back to a changed world, and a world that basically said to them, okay, well, we don't, you know, you've done your 4 years, now go away and be quiet about it.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reality of the borders and how it survived the Great War.
Mary, thank you very much. I'm glad we had a chance to just spend some time talking about the aftermath, because this is something that is overlooked.
Always, yes.
And in addition to that, we also have our scapegoats.
Always.
We should never forget that. Thanks a lot.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz, and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.